Hello and welcome to AAPT Comics Podcast. My name is David Brook. I am your co-host and I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth. Forrest, how you doing?
Hey, my name is Forrest with two R's. I'm doing all right. I'm here to talk comics. I'm here to talk, you were just talking about Teslas.
Yes, let's both buy a Tesla and then crash them.
James Tinian can buy a Tesla.
He can. This is the comic book podcast where we're going to recap all the news of the week. We're going to talk about comics that came out on October 7th, as well as talk about books out next week. We also have Dennis Hopeless Hallam on this show to talk about Exo Manowar. The first issue was out way back in March, but the second issue comes out November 25th. We'll be talking all about that new Valiant Comics series. But before we get there, the news, probably the biggest news, because this doesn't happen very often. The Department of Truth number one sells out past 100,000 copies, gets a second printing.
That's Tesla money, baby. I don't know I got so eager to talk about Teslas right before we started recording, but that is a massive, massive accomplishment.
I mean, especially because it's an indie book, right?
Yes, especially because it's a creator-owned indie book. I mean, I think it was put out by Image in partnership with Tinian's, like, Onion Press. Is that what it's called?
Tiny Onion. Yep.
Small Onion. He could fit many small onions in his new Tesla with his Department of Truth money!
If he likes the smell of onions, I would recommend it.
In all seriousness, I mean, we both really like this book. We talked about it at length last week. I've been thinking about it since then, which I think is always the sign of a good, especially a good number one.
Yeah.
And probably, it was probably the most frequently mentioned book in my Twitter feed last week by other creators and by critics and by fans in general. So I'm not surprised that it's successful. I'm maybe a little surprised that it's this successful.
Yeah, so what's interesting is they went, I mean, a lot of orders went in, right? I mean, because people were reviewing it early and talking about it months ago, all the comic shops were putting in many, many orders. So to reach 100,000 on first printing is kind of rare in itself. So that's kind of interesting. Also, It was the third highest selling comic for Image since 2008 when Eric Stevenson took over publishing duties at Image Comics. So,
right.
I mean, that's a lot of years ago.
That's true. I mean, I think that this is going to be a very big deal for them. And I think that even when you had mentioned in our Slack, David and I talk all the time, by the way, we were chatting about, you had read it before I got a chance to. And I asked you, is this what Image needs?
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
Meaning like a new Walking Dead, a new Saga. As both of those books kind of peter off and things like Undiscovered Country didn't really blossom into maybe what they were hoping for.
Right.
And I think that at the very least, that this trends in that direction.
You know, it's good news too in that when the news like this happens, movie studios come calling or streaming services come calling. I wouldn't be surprised if this is like in the works for a TV show within the next, I don't know, 6 months.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's great news though. It's James Tinian just keeps winning.
More good news.
James Tynan. Tynan? It's Tynan, isn't it?
I have no idea.
Tynan. No, it's Tynan.
My apologies.
I think. I don't know. James Tynan wrote up his newsletter, as he does, this week. And there's a bunch of news in there. Actually, I highly recommend checking out his newsletter and getting on it because he talks about all of his work. And he's writing books across publishers, not only indie publishers, but also DC. And you know that book? What's it called? Batman?
Heard of it.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty popular character. Well, he basically confirmed that he will be continuing on with Batman into 2021, and he said just recently a 22-page story bible was approved by the top brass at DC Comics, so good for him. What's interesting about this news, too, is there's been a lot of rumors and rumblings that with Batman number 100, he'd be done, and John Ridley would be taking over, but that is not the case.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think at the very least, Batman has been successful in the speculation market.
Yes, with Punchline.
You know, it is doing well with Punchline. It is doing well with variant covers. It is doing well with big characters and reveals and anthology issues and all those sorts of things. It is the polar opposite to what Tom King was trying to do with Batman.
Right.
Maybe DC's excited by that. And also, I think, like, we cannot overstate how much DC was probably upended by the recent Warner Brothers restructure.
Yeah.
And so maybe a sense of stability for Batman is just something that makes sense right now. mm-hmm. regardless of whatever other plans they had. That being said, a 22-page story Bible, is that, do you think it is going to come out in the form of like a handbook issue like they did for Ten of Swords?
Oh, that's interesting. Or do you
think it's going to be like appended to the end of the Batman issue?
I would say this is probably just for his eyes only, like charting out. It's probably like the next four arcs of his run or something like that. You know, the Joker War was, I think it's been quite successful this over the summer, and it just ended.
I mean, all the Joker properties have been really successful recently.
I just can't wait for the Joker War 2 for Jokers, which, you know, you heard it here first, folks. I just announced the book.
Joker War Squared.
No, Jorge Jimenez is also going to be continuing on with him. So that's other good news in this good news, because, I mean, Jimenez is doing some insane work. He works digitally, and I mean, I think he's doing some cutting edge stuff with the series, which is another reason why I think it was so successful.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have nothing against this current Batman run. I don't particularly care for it. I don't particularly care to read ongoing Batman stories in general. But it's just not your cup of tea. I actually would say that it has caught my interest more times than the King run did. So
I would agree with that.
Keep going with that.
Hopefully it will catch your interest someday, similar to Marvel Stormbreakers catching the interest of artists. That was a weird segue. I was trying to make it work. This week on Monday, Marvel launches their Marvel's Stormbreakers artist program, which is basically Marvel's Young Guns, which has been going on for many, many years. They just renamed it, essentially.
Okay, so there's a lot to talk about here.
A lot to unpack.
I'm going to try and boil it down to three things real quickly, but you can go ahead and lead in if you want.
A handful of artists, including Josh Cacera, Pat Gleason, Peach Momoko, Natasha Bustos, Ivan Coelho, Juan Cabal, Arby Silva, and Carmen Carnero are all part of this two-year program. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that they are exclusive, but I would say that they probably are.
They definitely have trended that way with the Young Guns in the past. Yeah.
We know, though, that Peach Momoko's got like 10 more variant covers to do at Boom, so I don't know, maybe that's okay because this deal just came through. I mean, we've discussed
before that I think exclusivity really means don't work for DC.
Yeah, you're probably right.
And to a lesser degree, probably Dark Horse, Dynamite, Boom, etc. But it's definitely like an anti-DC contingent.
Right.
And obviously, Pat Gleason has jumped ship from DC over to Marvel for the foreseeable future anyway.
True.
A couple of things about this real quickly.
Yeah, let's do it.
Pat Gleason has been working in comics for 20 plus years.
And that's why they changed it from Young Guns to Stormbreakers.
They did, but is it functionally different, or does it feel functionally different at all to you?
Not at all.
Because they're still advertising it as the next generation of artists.
They are, yeah.
Then, Stormbreakers, okay, that doesn't tell me anything.
The name itself?
The name itself doesn't tell me a single thing about what it is.
That's true. Young Guns was better at that, for sure.
Yes, absolutely. And Storm anything with a lightning bolt logo is a bad look.
How do you mean?
It has Nazi connotations.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah.
By the way, that design is by Tom Muller, who's all over Marvel these days. I saw him talking about it on his Twitter.
Yeah. So I mean, the Nazi Stormfront. Nazi Storm Elite, the Nazi Storm Troopers, the Storm.
That's an interesting take.
All of that stuff. And then also, I mean, the double lightning bolt logo for the SS.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of stuff that, like, it's not one small niche thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big enough issue that Marvel PR should have caught it.
That's interesting. Were people talking about that this week on
Twitter?
I did
see some discussion about it, yeah.
Interesting.
I quite personally feel like it's a misfire on all fronts, because I also think that announcing someone like Patrick Gleason or someone like Silva, who's working on your biggest book right now, Ten of Swords. Yeah.
And is amazing, amazing. I mean, they're all amazing artists, really.
You're discrediting their work.
By saying that they're up and coming?
Right, by saying that Patrick Gleason has finally broken through. It's like when someone says you got lucky winning an Oscar when you went to acting classes for 20 years.
I just heard there's a new Disney program called Hurricane Breakers, and Ridley Scott is part of the new Young Guns. It is very strange. I mean, yeah, especially like someone like Pat Gleason. I think he's been in the business a little bit longer than most of these other folks. But like they've all earned their right to be considered some of the best artists in the comic book industry now.
Absolutely. I have nothing against the talent at all. I think that these are great picks for if you're basically just saying these are you might as well call them flagship artists.
I feel like the program should just come out and say it. Like,
yeah,
these people are exclusive to Marvel and not DC. I feel like that would be a more interesting topic in the news than this thinly veiled artist program, you know?
If we were to workshop it right now, I would say these new exclusive Marvel artists will be leading our flagship stories for a new generation of storytelling.
That's good, yeah. And even say, like, for the next 2 years.
Right. Give me specifics.
It's interesting, like, if you look at the press release, it even, like, kind of buries the two-year thing, which I feel like you should put that in the front of your marketing, because then people are like, oh, they've got a plan for 2 years. Like, it gives you confidence in what they're doing. Instead, it's like, it's like just being so, like, I don't know, cagey about it. It's strange. Yeah,
I don't know. I think it kind of fails on every front.
Mm.
And we could talk about it at length, but I'm generally unimpressed with the way Marvel's marketing has been operating for the last year. That is to say nothing of how good the creators are.
They sure are. Because
this is a great roster.
It is. CNN anchor Jake Tapper also put together a great roster this week on Twitter when he implored his followers to vote by using imagery of the Joker, Lex Luthor, and some other, I think a lot of people were replying with art as well, but he also used an old 1993 Spider-Man ad to rock the vote. This is a bit of news I wrote up on a whim on Monday morning, and I just thought it was funny. It ended up getting a lot of views. I don't think anyone else reported on it, actually. Apparently, Jake Tapper is a big comic book fan, so it wasn't a surprise to many. It is interesting, though, when he posted the vote for Lex art, he basically said, I need to get both sides of the political spectrum. So then he posted Joker, but they're both evil. They're both bad guys. Wouldn't the both sides be Superman and Lex, not Joker and Lex?
Yes.
Unless
he's on some galaxy brain shit.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. It's always about the lesser of two evils in the American political situation. So maybe Joker and Lex make sense. Any thoughts on this, on him using comic book art to help rock the vote?
I mean, he picked something that is very recognizable to people. And I think it's structured to strike at the heart of, like, patriotism or American idealism. So
yeah.
More power to him.
Moving on, the Harvey Awards took place this week. And actually, they were announced early via the Hollywood Reporter, who constantly seems to be getting all the comic book scoops these days. I'm not sure why, but like Boom, DC, Marvel, they're all going to Hollywood Reporter and giving them some big news bites each week. Maybe they just have a stronger comic book section or something. But yeah, the Harvey Awards were announced just a few weeks ago, and now we've got the winners. Book of the Year was Dragon Hoops by Gene Luen Yang. Digital Book of the Year was The Nib by Matt Boers. Best Manga, Witch Hat Atelier by Kamome Sharama. At Kodansha. Best adaptation from a comic book graphic novel, Watchmen by HBO. No surprise there.
Yeah.
We talked about this a couple weeks ago. The nominees. This was an interesting award show in that they actually had a category that wasn't just comics. They had, because also for best adaptation was the Joker movie. And some, remember how wild the nominees were? It was like, how do you even decide on these things?
Yeah, it's one of the few award ceremonies that I feel is actually forward thinking in that regard. And that understanding comics have kind of evolved beyond just being single floppy issues. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, the Eisners and stuff, they attempted that. But this, I don't know. I'm impressed with it. I'm interested by it.
What do you think of the fact that they released the winners, but the actual award ceremony wasn't for a couple days after, on October 9th? For the New York Comic Con MCM Comic Con Metaverse.
I think it's a pandemic, baby.
Yeah.
Whatever. Listen, we're going to let you know way in advance, and if you want to come, you can.
Right.
Or if you want to call in or whatever.
I do prefer it, but the Comic Con at home,
Eisner award show was awkward as hell, and it was like, it was a video you could scrub through, so you could like literally just skip nominees if you wanted. It was not very well done.
And there was all sorts of mispronunciations and all sorts of trouble with that too. So I don't know. I don't know that I am glad that I am not in charge of running an award ceremony right now.
Forrest, if you had to
mm-hmm.
be the announcer for an award show, what would the award show be? You know, announcing? What would be the categories? What would be the theme?
Oh, wow. Are we talking specifically about comics or anything?
Anything.
Probably wrestling stuff.
See, my first guess was little dogs.
I do love small dogs. I have two small dogs. I love small. Okay. Yes.
Fluffiest little dog.
Smallest.
And the award for
smallest creature.
Oh, that's good. It even opens it up more. Baby skunk wins best use of color or lack
smallest
of color.
Smallest size, biggest smell.
Oh my god, the quips. It'd be so easy.
And yeah, puns? Actually, that sounds very fun.
We should just do that in our own time.
we'll have an audience of Patreon. One.
Our partners will just look aghast as we host the show, just you and I. I'll hand you the awards and you digitally.
And I'll print them. I'll print off a JPEG to give to a skunk.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect. We have to have lots of treats, though, ready for the animals. In our next bit of news, Tom Taylor and John Somarriva are going to Random House with a new book called Neverlanders. Tom Taylor announced it on his Twitter a few days ago. This is yet another young adult, middle grade comic coming our way. He said Random House, Penguin Random House, but he must mean Random House Graphic, I would have to say, right? I mean, that's where it's listed, but...
I mean, maybe. I don't know. We've been talking a lot about graphic novels being pushed into the book market more and more.
Yeah.
So maybe he said what he meant.
Yeah, could be. It looks fun. It has goblins, and I'm curious about this. And it's kind of cool. You know, he can't just write Spider-Man and deceased for the rest of his life. More of the latter.
You know, yes. He's also probably one of the hardest working comics writers, right?
Oh my god, he's like, so many books.
Do you think he's using the collective cultural subconscious or energy of all of Australia? How is he powering through so much writing?
Mm. Well, they definitely have less of a coronavirus issue right, than us.
I guess he's not depressed and stressed out all the time.
When he was on the podcast a few weeks ago, he made it very clear he hates guns, so maybe he doesn't have that stress on his brain like Americans do.
Wow.
I have a feeling if you're as hardworking as him, there is a better ability to tap into the zeitgeist.
Mm.
And I have a feeling like that's maybe one thing one reason why he's so productive is like he's constantly got these ideas. But in other news, Ryan Otley is going to have no more Spider-Man ideas very soon. Actually, it's already up because Ryan Otley revealed on Twitter that Amazing Spider-Man number 49, aka Amazing Spider-Man 850, was his last Spider-Man work.
Yes.
And then Newsarama had the news that Mark Bagley was taking over. Good old Mark Bagley. He's always good for a good Spider-Man comic.
Mainstay. Yep. You gotta tap someone in. Mark Bagley's a good one.
He is. He's been there for decades. Guy's just, he loves the character apparently.
Yeah.
So the news came as a bit of a shock for a couple reasons. I'll just list two. One, it just came out of nowhere and no one even mentioned it. Like, usually this kind of news comes out, you know, weeks earlier before the book even comes out. And then the other thing is, you know, remembering how Ryan Otley talked about taking on Spider-Man, like this was his life's work. Like he always, when he was doing Invincible, he even then was talking about how he'd love to do Spider-Man. And so he finally got his dream job. And after just 2 years, he's no longer on Spider-Man. And now he did say that he would come back eventually, probably, but maybe not on a main series. But
maybe not on a book with Nick Spencer.
Maybe it's because
he was very cordial. He was very polite in his tweets. He tweeted out a thread about working on Spider-Man and how much he enjoyed it and how he was happy to do it, that he also wants to pursue other creative projects, et cetera, et cetera. That all read to me like, I don't want to work with this team anymore, or I'm not interested in this book anymore. Those sorts of things, which, I mean, comparatively, he worked on Invincible for a decade.
Right. Right.
You know, like he's down to do the work when it's going in a direction that he cares about or he likes, or he's working with someone that he likes. And so I will say that I think that this reflects kind of poorly on Spider-Man editorial and on Nick Spencer in particular. Especially because they advertised Otley a lot, and they haven't gone out in front of this and started advertising Bagley at all.
Right. Maybe because Bagley is just like a fill-in.
It's really weird and it's really ill-timed. I mean, issue 50 has huge reveals, we've been told.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really weird, it seems like a really pivotal moment, and they haven't capitalized on it in any way or even messaged it in any way, which makes me think something is afoot.
One of the reasons why Otley was so good on my Spider-Man, spider sense is it tingling?
Yes.
What was that in the movie, the Parker tingle?
Yeah.
Was it? Yeah, that was good. If you've read his Spider-Man, or if you've seen his Spider-Man work, and if you've seen his Invincible work, he has a lot of positive energy, and his style is just, it's so happy making, and I don't think the series has been very happy making for quite some time, so it's almost like his style doesn't fit with the work. I mean, we've got this Sin Eater story where it's super dark and moody, and you know his art needs to be free and more splashy, I feel.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It just feels like the work has kind of put him in a box.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely be interested in having a larger discussion about what's going on with Amazing Spider-Man at some time, because I do think it's really fascinating on a micro and macro level, and we could break down writing and art and arcs and crossovers and tie-ins and...
Right.
I have a lot to say about that book.
Right, we could do a segment on it.
Yeah.
We just keep getting guests, so we can't.
I will say, on the front of fill-ins, you mentioned that Bagley might be a fill-in. I think that's probably true. I don't know who I anticipate to be the next main artist. And even, to some degree, they ended up using Otley more as a fill-in artist at some times, too. I imagine it felt difficult for him to feel like he was half of the book.
Yeah.
Because he was off of it so often.
Yeah, on Saturday morning, I saw he tweeted, he was tweeting in reply to someone who was saying, oh, he's been on it for 2 years. I wish he did more. And he was like straight up like, I have friends and family I want to see. So 8 to 10 issues a year is already pushing it for me. So yeah. He's been outspoken.
Time intensive, you know, and I respect that.
He's been outspoken in the past. Like, he doesn't want this to be his life, like his all of his life just to draw comics. So.
Yeah,
it's understandable.
And they did slow down the Invincible timeline for him at some point in the past. So I don't know. That all tracks. I wish him the absolute best. I also wish the absolute best for Amazing Spider-Man in the future. But that's a story for another time.
Let's just say this. Mark Bagley is like one of the only artists on the face of the planet who could draw every issue of a series.
True. That is true. I mean,
he was even drawing 2 issues a month for Bendis for a while there. Like, the dude's a machine. Yeah. I don't know how he does it.
That's true.
And we've seen with Patrick Gleason, too. He can't keep up with the schedule.
No, right. And that's also, not to speak ill of them at all. It's just like...
No, not at all. It's prioritization
and how good your workflow and stuff is. And it's entirely different for different artists. I don't want anyone to get carpal tunnel or anything.
I mean, if you look at comics today versus, like, the 80s or 70s, like, it's just... The readers they demand a higher quality that is literally impossible to pull off monthly, unless they are given months and months of head time.
Absolutely.
Speaking of months and months of head time, Eternals, the new comic book series, is being delayed to January 6th. It was supposed to come out November 11th originally. It was solicited for. This is Kieran Gillen and Asad Ribic's new series that has much hyped, already has a trailer, and many people are very excited for.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, it's only delayed a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think it may have been just delayed just so they could launch the new year with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a high-profile project.
For sure. Yeah, they don't want to get this messed up. Plus, as we all know, the Eternals movie is delayed, so there's probably less incentive to get it out as early as possible. Speaking of the glitz and glamour of Hollywood, Hulu will be creating commercials for Marvel Comics in their new MODOK series.
Yeah, so specifically about the comics.
Yeah.
They are going to air commercials for specific Marvel Comics runs during MODOK.
I can't wait to see them.
It's weird that they are. I'm sure that they're actually partnering on it much more than it is being indicated. Mm-hmm. But they definitely are saying that Hulu has part in making the commercials.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really interesting. They haven't successfully capitalized on... I still think, like, the movies do a really good job of selling you Funko Pops and action figures and stuff.
Yeah.
But they've never found a way to successfully make the MCU a comics seller.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily translate.
I mean, it makes sense in that you make $4 a comic, you don't make... You make $15 a ticket to a movie,
right,
in a way.
Right, right. Right. And so this is really interesting. This feels like their first foray really into like trying to direct people back to the source material. And we'll see if it's successful. Also, did you know the MODOK show is like stop motion animation?
Yeah, I had no idea.
Yeah, it looks like Robot Chicken, which I guess makes sense, like, because one of the Robot Chicken people is the executive producer or whatever.
It does make me, I mean, it looks awesome, but it makes me nervous when you and I included, the first thought you had is this Robot Chicken, but with Marvel?
Yeah.
it's a little, I don't want to say it's problematic, but it's a bit of an issue for general fans, because when they start making the comparison, it puts the new MODOK show in a tricky place.
In a specific niche. Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. I do think that, like, combined with Hulu being really in on this, the stop motion animation thing, commercials for comics, all sorts of other stuff. They really are in a period of experimentation again.
Yeah.
After what, like 11 years of MCU movies coming out every year.
Yeah. I mean, they just had S.H.I.E.L.D. for the longest time.
Right.
And Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
And that was, I think, aesthetically still really similar to the MCU.
Right.
So this feels like a period of trying new things out. And I'm excited by that.
Yeah, and they've got Hellstrom coming out too, right, which is part of the continuity. A lot of irons in the fire for Marvel. Yet at the same time, no new movies in 2020.
Yeah.
Womp womp. So sad. Can they just put up Black Widow? I want to watch it.
I think it'll probably hit. What's their streaming service called? God.
Disney Plus?
Disney Plus.
Technically, they There's own Hulu, too.
Too many.
Disney is I don't know if they're a full owner, but they're a part owner of Hulu.
Yes, they own a controlling majority.
Fucking Disney probably owns everything.
Yes, true.
They own part of our souls when we're born. In order to get a last name, Disney has to gain the rights to your first name. It's very complicated. this is not on our sheet, but there are new Black Widow Cinematic Universe variant covers starting this month. Take what you will from that news. I mean, more than likely they were supposed to start back in the summer when Black Widow was already out.
Yeah,
it probably got to the point where they were like, well, we kind of need to start making money on this art that's sitting in the shelf. But you know, conspiracy theorists will think, oh, this means the movie's coming in January and we'll all be able to watch it on Disney Plus. Something else we'll be able to watch on streaming services. HBO Max announced on Friday a new Green Lantern show is in the works. They finally did it, folks. They already did it with Ryan Reynolds. That's right. Damn. I think we've all forgotten about that movie, didn't we? But I know that a lot of people have been whining for quite a while. Like, why wasn't he in Justice League? The Snyder Cut was supposed to have Green Lantern. The Snyder Cut is evil and terrible. Okay, and we should never talk about it.
Even the mention of it is exhausting me.
Did you see the Snyder Cut please. Assholes?
No, please. We can't do this.
The Doc Shaner thing?
Yeah, which he then tweeted wasn't even true. So that's
Oh, really?
A whole,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that part. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anywho, so they will, they've greenlit a show that will feature Alan Scott, Jessica Cruz, and more.
I like that you said greenlit.
I'm psyched for Jessica Cruz, a newer Green Lantern, a good character to highlight.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also excited they don't have... Hal in this. It's Guy Gardner as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yes.
He's the biggest one.
Yeah.
And you got to have Kilowog.
I mean, you have like these kind of the newer generation of Green Lantern characters. You have Doom Patrol. You have an animated Harley Quinn show. Like, they're also very much in a cool phase of experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
Shaking it up. And like HBO, I have to imagine, is very happy about their partnership with DC. And vice versa.
You know, with the success of The Boys, I'm very curious if they will make this a little more adult.
It is HBO Max, so most of their stuff does lean into an adult realm, right? Like,
I mean, Doom Patrol, Swamp Thing, and the Harley Quinn show certainly do.
Right. Raised by Wolves.
Yeah.
So basically, this was already announced a year ago, but they've greenlit a 10 one-hour episode run.
Okay.
Which will start shooting, who knows, 2050 when the pandemic is over.
I saw that they delayed the new Shazam movie to 2023.
Ugh.
So, yes.
There was a lot of movie delays this week, including James Bond, which really bummed me out.
And Dune.
And Dune, yeah, there's that one too. They're a bunch of poosers. See what I did there? Uh-huh. In our next segment, Top Books of the Week, we talk about our top two favorite comics out this week. Forrest, what is your second favorite comic of the week?
My second favorite comic of the week is The Rise of Ultraman number 2. This is written by Kyle Higgins and Matt Groom with art by Francesco Manna. I don't really have much to say about it. I think that they really finally laid out what the narrative thrust of the Ultraman series, or at least this first wave of Ultraman stories, is going to be at Marvel. And I'm really interested in it. I think that they're doing a good job of synthesizing what appeals about Marvel Comics to certain readers. Superhero-centric stories, hope is in all of us, like, anyone can be the hero, you can wear the mask type storytelling, with the absolute weirdness of Ultraman and Kaiju storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited by where it's going from here.
The art is insane.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And, you know, and this issue has a much better sense of humor than the first issue had.
Mm.
They're like, there's one scene where two characters are driving up on a shack, and he's like, I bet that this is where the secret weapon is. And the girl is like, oh no, they wouldn't have a secret weapon here. It's just a farm. And the caption says, like, redacted site of the redacted weapon.
Yeah, that's good.
I laughed out loud at that, and I hope that the book leans more into that kind of stuff.
I loved how it dug into the Ultraman lore, like the backstory of these creatures or aliens or whatever you want to call them. Mm-hmm. And there's a cool meaning in there. There's a meaning in there that you could take from, like, hey, maybe we need these aliens to save our universe. Because seriously, things are screwed up.
That's kind of what I mean in the sense of, especially given what happens at the end of the issue, which, I mean, people that know Ultraman know what's coming. But I do think that they're doing a really good job of making it relevant.
For sure. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. My second favorite book of the week was Marauders number 13, which makes Storm relevant. Is that a good hook? I don't know.
I think that there's a couple Storm fans who just perked up.
What I mean is there's a lot of different shades of Storm being revealed in this book. We get the diplomat, we get the hero, we get the heist puller offer, if you want to call it that. As rudely as I just said. Vita Ayala does a really good job. Just like, the book feels like you didn't even have to read Ten of Swords. You could just read this and it's entertaining.
Yeah, Vita, they definitely have a very defined voice for Storm in their head.
For sure, yeah. And, you know, I wasn't expecting to like it as much as I did because, not to get into it, but, you know, X-Force and Wolverine were not very good, in my opinion. And then this is the third chapter of the week that we got this week, so the fifth chapter, and I was just blown away by, like, even the sword, the backstory about the sword that Storm has to steal is really cool. I'm not sure if it's rewriting Wakandan history, which made me kind of go, I wonder if that's problematic for fans, but I don't know. There's a lot here. There's a lot of storytelling. There's a lot of Storm, good character writing. And I think Matteo Lolli did a pretty great job throughout. I had some issues with, like, how, like, body parts were, like, warping because of the speed, but it looked strange. Aside from that, though, just a stellar book. And if you were wondering where Black Panther was, possibly you should read this issue.
Yeah. I thought it was a good issue as well. I didn't want to repeat here. I don't want to talk about Ten of Swords to death or anything like that, but suffice to say that all these books are at least good.
Yeah, I think Solemn there is interesting.
Yeah, yeah, very much.
Did you read Wolverine and X?
Yep, I'm caught up.
We should do a whole segment on those two issues because I could talk forever.
We can't do it.
There's so many segments, so little time. What is your favorite comic of the week?
My favorite comic of the week surprised me. Cyberpunk 2077 Trauma Team number 2, written by Cullen Bunn with art by Miguel Valderrama. I want to, again, preface this by saying I am aware of the problematic nature of the Cyberpunk video game and the cyberpunk production studio CD Projekt Red with regards to transphobia, homophobia, and like, I don't want work crunch, employee mistreatment, labor practices. But a really fantastic comic, and Bunn and Valderrama have a very realized vision of the cyberpunk universe. This issue, I'm kind of bummed actually that we're halfway through the story at this point.
Yeah, it's a short one.
This issue really gets into the character drama in a way that the first issue didn't. The first issue was kind of reliant on like shock value, not in a derivative way, but that this in a way really deepens even that first issue, the events of that first issue. And I really, really enjoyed that. It kind of doubles down on the Dread movie plot where they're like trapped in a hallway and fighting off villains. Moving strategically through these hallways and stuff. But this kind of back and forth, the parallel storytelling, past and future, richening what is in the in this issue and then also in the previous issue. And I think we're going to kind of going to get that iterative process for every issue. Really, really interesting, really fantastic. The what do you call that? Slang is all picture perfect, accurate, good. I can tell that these creators are fans of the universe first. And not...
That's always important.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they definitely are cashing in on the massive popularity of cyberpunk.
Right.
But, and I would too. Get that money, get that bag, get that Tesla. Get that Tinian money.
Yes! We need to ask Dennis about Teslas.
But I also think that they care very much about telling a good story that is appropriate for the cyberpunk universe. It doesn't feel like it existed outside of like a genre or a license first. It feels like it was crafted for this. And I think that that's the most that you can ask for licensed comics.
Right, yeah, because there's a tethering of like the super fan and the casual as well.
Right.
Yeah, I liked it too. It was good. You're so right, though. It's so short. It's like...
Yeah.
Give us more.
Yeah, it's only four issues. It's not even five. So...
Get out of town.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's only four issues.
Seriously, get out of town.
Okay.
Get out of town! My favorite book of the week was American Vampire 1976 number one, and I have to tell you, I own an American Vampire trade, but I do not own all like 10 of them. I think there's 10 or 8. So I'm not some diehard fan, which is why I was so shocked that I liked this first issue so much. It's got amazing art by Rafael Albuquerque. Obviously, it's written by Scott Snyder, and I have to point out Dave McCraig did an amazing job with the color work. Dave is also doing the colors on the new Walking Dead re-release, color version re-release of all the issues. And yeah, so as a casual reader of American Vampire who kind of knows what it's about, I was just pulled into all these characters' narratives. This is set in 1976, but it also goes back to 1741, where we find out in the Virginia colony, there was men's jobs to find monster trees, rip up the root, and kill the dead baby that's growing off the root. There is like a sickness or a monster that's in our earth that's trying to come out. And that's sort of the core problem in the issue where I think it's going to be a 9-issue run. I think there's going to be this monster they have to vanquish eventually. But in this first issue, we're introduced to a heist plot where... at the time, this is a real thing. The president, Ford, I think he, Gerald Ford, was it? Anyway, he had a train that went around the country with American, with artifacts, which included, Dorothy's red slippers, but also like Ben Franklin's like,
nuts.
Copy of the Constitution. Nuts?
I tried to guess.
Oh, but like, It's a perfect setup for a heist because there's all these like valuable American items, but of course there is a train car with something in it. We don't know what it is. They have to get.
Oh,
so there's that kind of thing going on too. But yeah, I just really really liked there's horror, but it's also adventure. There's kind of like an Indiana Jones vibe to some of it. So it captured a lot of different genres in one. I don't know these characters as well as you know longtime readers, but I understood their point of view. One of the main characters, who's a vampire his whole life, hates being alive. So, like, he's this hero that, you know, is reluctant. So you've got elements like that that are all kind of gelling really well. I'll probably read this whole series, even though I didn't read most of American Vampire. So, yeah, I think you should totally check it out, even if you're a casual fan like me.
Yeah, I mean, I've never, ever read American Vampire, but I maybe will. I like the central narrative thrust, at least. That's cool.
Yeah, it's neat. It's not too... as opposed to Dark Knight's Death Metal, it's not this insurmountable, vast, giant story, and you're trying to like wrap your head around it. It's like it's got a nugget in there to track, but there is a bigger story underneath the ground and the roots, literally and figuratively. I can't say it figuratively. In our top books for next week, we're going to talk about our number one book that we can't wait for, and I can guess for us. Not just because it's on
not because
our
you
notes.
Can see it right now.
Because you've been talking about it for
yes.
quite a while, weeks, if not months.
Yes.
What is your top book for next week?
My top book for next week is Marvel's first Warhammer 40,000 comic, Marnaeus Khalgar number 1, written by Kieran Gillen with art by Jason Burrows. I've already had the fortune to read this. I think it's fascinating. I think Gillen really, really cares about giving people a good entry point to the vastness and the denseness that is Warhammer 40,000 lore and the world. But I also think that he found a very specific niche, very specific story to tell for super fans, for a character that hasn't been really touched on or explored in this way before, despite their prominence, which I think is something that Gillen is really, really good at. We can talk about it more next week. I'm also going to be writing an article that will be out there on the interwebs. You can find it on my Twitter, I'm sure. And I'm just really, really excited about this. I hope that people like it enough or as much as I did so that we get a broader 40K line.
Yeah, because it's only 5-issue miniseries, right?
Right.
Right. And given the vastness of this universe and the world building required for new fans.
There's infinite possibilities for
five
stories.
Issues isn't going to cut it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. My most anticipated book of the week is Commanders in Crisis number 1 by Steve Orlando with art by David Tinto. This is a book we already reviewed on aptcomics.com. You should check it out by David Mann. His review is quite good. Essentially, Steve Orlando has been writing comics for the Big Two for quite a while. A little less for Marvel, I suppose. But guy's got some good ideas. And this book is all about superhero ideas. He's basically given carte blanche to do whatever he wants with superheroes in an interesting setup. I will say it introduces a lot of different characters, some of which, of course, are, you know, familiar. I won't say copies, but, you know, like similar to like you got your Superman, you got your yada, yada, yada. And so you've got a super team book here. And it kind of... there's an intro, a foreword, I guess you'd call it, by Dan Didio, which is kind of cool to read. Dan Didio is, of course, the ex-president, or is he publisher, at DC Comics.
Publisher.
And he basically explains, like, you know, Steve's been doing superhero books for quite some time, and this is like the culmination of all that work, but now original and creator-owned. So you basically get to meet all these characters. Obviously, I've already read it, but you get to meet all these characters, and there's a hook at the end that just totally got me. And it's in the title. I will say no more. If you're a reader of comic book events, you will probably really, really like the ending of this and where he's going with it. But yeah, if you check back on aptcomics.com this week, Ritesh Babu has an interview, a very unique interview with Steve Orlando, and I'll say no more on that either. Moving on, in our Judging by the Cover Junior segment, we're going to pick our favorite cover art out next week. You want me to go first?
I can go first. You can go first. Here's a little behind the scenes for folks. We have a giant stack of comic books, floppy issues that we've been sent. We have to sort through all of them every week. David and I live on the literal opposite sides of the country from each other. So they send us half and half, and we just have to kind of hold it up on Zoom and say yay or no. And then we narrow down every comic release every week until we get one.
It's a, what would you say, 10 or 12 hour process?
24.
24 hour process. Yeah, we don't stop until we're done.
You forgot both days. 12 hours each day.
Okay, we do have a break. We do have a break in between. Yeah, I don't know why we don't ever just look on Comixology or websites that list off all the cover art, but this is our, this is the way it works for the show.
Yeah, but more realistically, I'm looking at the Previews magazine every week, Previews World, and sometimes we pick things that are off the date. I originally picked
especially with this pandemic,
Frank Miller comic, but yeah, because of the pandemic, things have been shifted all over the place. So if we get it wrong, I'm sorry.
They'll forgive us. If they're listening to us right now, 45 minutes into the show, they've already forgiven us 1,000 times.
Yeah.
My favorite cover art is by a guy named Alex Ross. It's Captain America number 24. It's a bit of a cheat, we know, to pick Alex Ross on the show, but this is one of the most amazing covers I've ever seen in my life. It's the Red Skull standing with his leather jacket open, or I guess it's not open, but there's a light inside him of all the dead bodies and bones, and it looks like very emaciated people, pile of them inside of him. I'm going to guess it's a reference to the Holocaust. It is incredibly disturbing and dark, and it's yet another horrific cover by Alex Ross in the sense of horror, and that seems to be the theme he's been going with for quite some time, over a year at least, of his of most of his covers in Immortal Hulk and even Conan. And just the level of detail and disturbing nature to this, it's a work of art. I could see this in a museum someday. It's really something, and it makes you think. It makes you think about, you know, what is the message here? We know Red Skull's a Nazi, and he has a terrible past and terrible spirit, of course, so maybe there's something with it there, but I don't know. It's just, it's an insane cover.
My pick, Hellions number 5.
You should have went first. That's
a Ten of Swords cover, a variant cover by Sarah Pacelli.
Yeah.
Psylocke has a sword.
It's a pretty cool sword. I like how she's holding it up.
It's a pretty cool sword.
It looks like she's her shirt's made of space.
Yeah, it does. It's got a neat, like, splatter effect over the top of it, kind of an overlay. There's, like, a really cool, like, scratchy shine off of the hilt of the sword, too. And I love her, like, her gloves only cover 2 fingers.
Yeah,
it's like, it's very neat, and she's got like different colored finger paint on the nails. It's neat. I don't know, it's a great depiction, a close-up depiction of one of my favorite X-Men characters.
Do you think Psylocke would be good at close-up magic?
Yes.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's what those the holes in her gloves are for. So she can do close-up magic with her tarot cards.
So she can hide the cards in her sleeves.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Actually, she doesn't really have sleeves, does she?
Well, she has neck of arm tights. Arm gaiters.
It is weird how she has, like, the strips. Yeah, I guess that's because like, it's wrapped. Sleeves. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. Very, very, very fascinating. Almost as fascinating as her talk with Dennis Hopeless Hallam, which is right now.
Here we go.
On with us is Dennis Hopeless. You are the writer of XO Manowar. Issue number 1's come out. Issue number 2's out November 25th. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So first and foremost, how are you holding up during the pandemic?
Pretty well. It was an odd time to have to be stuck at home because I had just finished a major home renovation. Inherited a house from an elderly relative, and we gutted it and completely renovated it. And the plan was, like, it's going to be a great entertaining space. It's all wide open now. And then right as we got done, the world shut down and no one's allowed to come in my house. So I have a really nice space that has had nothing in it. Like, I'd barely even gotten furniture. And I have 2 small children who are with me half the time, and their school shut down. So essentially, I rode a lot of bikes and played a lot of Nerf Wars and chase my kids around. But no, it's
been there are worse things.
That's true. That is true.
Yes, I feel like I know my children a lot better now because I didn't have that like 6 to 8 hours a day of them being in school. That was all on me.
Sure.
So that was the upside for sure.
So we are kind of in a weird position where the first issue of XO came out in March.
Yeah.
That's right? The right timeline? Yes. And the next issue is coming out next month, the end of next month. So we have a couple of questions that are about kind of the XO Manowar run in general, and then some more narrow questions about follow-up issues, just so you know. The first one that I have here is, can you tell us a little bit about your history with Exo Manamor? Did you have a pitch in mind for the property, or did it all kind of fall together when you got in touch with Valiant?
Well, so my history with Valiant is weird, because when I first, like right before I broke into Marvel, whenever I was working on my first couple Marvel books, but they weren't out yet, I got approached to pitch on one of the original relaunch books back in 2011. Mm. And so like I was in the running to be on one of those books back then, and read a bunch of stuff, and it didn't work out. I don't remember what scheduling or something, it was a long time ago. And then a good friend of mine who was my first Marvel editor, Alejandra Arbona, for a while was an editor at Valiant, and he and I talked about stuff, but that never materialized. And then the year before I was offered Exo, I pitched on three different things that didn't end up happening.
Oh, so wow.
When Heather approached me about Exo, I was like, I mean, that'd be fun. It's an awesome character. I love Exo, but I feel like I'm cursed at your company. But I like Heather a lot, and I've known her from Marvel. And what she wanted to do with the book was like super in line with what I had always wanted to do with Valiant properties, which is like figure out a way to take that real world, like superheroes versus tanks and army thing, and then take it into a weird direction, kind of like weird sci-fi it up in a way that makes sense, and have a book that's like really fun and strange and exciting. And what she told me she wanted to do was kind of Thor Ragnarok Exo. And at that point, I was definitely pitching this thing. Like, that sounded fantastic to me. I had read a lot of the old 90s stuff, and then I read Exo when it first started coming out in 2011, but I hadn't read anything in between. So, I just sat down and read everything in between, saw what they had done, and tried to find a lane that wasn't too different, like didn't change the character and the relationships, but that was something we hadn't seen for a while with Exo. So that was my pitch, was like, how do we do Thor Ragnarok, but on Earth with a character that's been in space or fighting space things for a long time? And that's where we came at it.
That's funny. It kind of leads right into our next question, which is, how do you reconcile all this history, all these reboots, all these new number ones, and then what you want to do?
I mean, okay, so I learned how to do that when I wrote Cable, because Cable is a character whose history makes no sense.
You're right, yeah.
Like, just reading his Wikipedia entry will give you a headache. And Exo's not quite that complicated, but they have, you know, he has been reinvented a couple of times. And the way that I always approached it was, all of these things happened to this person, and so this person has the scars and the perspective and the personal growth of having gone through it. But it doesn't necessarily come up in conversation all the time, right? Like the stuff. Right.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe you don't talk about very often, but it, you know, it helped form you. So for me, it was all about figuring out where he is now and how that stuff from his past, from his very checkered, you know, like time and universe hopping past, has affected who he is now and where we want to go. And how that allows him to relate to modern day humans and Shannara and all of the, you know, the different stuff we're doing to him, as opposed to like, how do we tie this together with continuity that some people have read and some people haven't, and like bring stuff in. Like, I don't know, that writing comics about old comics is kind of problematic when you're trying to launch something new, but you right. also don't want to alienate the former readers. So yeah, it's more just like, this is the tapestry of his life and he's moving forward from this point.
That makes sense.
Do you think that there's a specific run or creator's take on the character that has informed what you're doing the most?
No, I kind of love all of it, to be honest. Like, I was excited. A lot of times when you have a character that's gone through a couple different iterations, there are things that you love and things that you hate, and I kind of just read it all in one fell, you know, like just sat down and read it for a few days, and that informed the character. It's been a really good book. I mean, that was the hardest thing about this, is that I feel like it's been really strong, especially since the relaunch. Like, both of those big runs were fantastic.
Yeah.
And we're heading in a different direction. So my big thing was mostly like, how do we not mess this cool stuff up, but do things we've never seen before? I kind of just threw it all in the blender.
Sure.
How does working with Valiant differ from working with other publishers like Marvel?
It's pretty similar. The main difference between Valiant and Marvel is just that there's fewer moving parts. Like, there aren't as many books happening at the same time. You know, trying to use existing Marvel villains, for instance, is a problem sometimes, or like locations, because there's so many books happening at the same time. But from the outset of the new XO, we're not really interacting that much with the rest of the Valiant universe. He's mostly off in his own little corner. That'll change as we go forward. But so there's a little bit more freedom, but it's very much, you know, they're very much building a Valiant universe, like a Valiant world that's cohesive and everything exists within it. So that's similar. But I don't know. There's quite a bit of freedom with it.
That's cool.
Speaking of freedom, and I'm going to leave this one a little bit open to interpretation. What do you think is the one thing every XO Manowar run must do?
Blow shit up.
I mean, the cool thing about it was going to be something like that. Fight dinosaurs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have like an ancient badass warrior who, you know, lived by the steel, and then you put him in a nuclear weapon suit that can do pretty much anything and fight anything. So you, the challenge, he kind of has the Superman problem where you have to make the things he's battling big and scary enough that it poses a threat. But once you do that, yeah, he can destroy cities. He can, you know, he can do all sorts of crazy mayhem. So yeah, it has to have those explosions and that crazy violent action to work, I think.
When we were preparing for this interview, I had to look up XO, of course, on Wikipedia, and there is a laundry list of powers this dude's got.
Yeah.
I wanted to just list a couple off, see if we're going to see these powers being used, if you would be so kind.
Sure.
Teleportation?
Not yet, but I wouldn't put it past me.
Nice. ESP?
I didn't even know he had that.
Sure, there are some bangers in here.
Yeah, it's crazy. Technopathy?
Yes.
Nice. Halted aging, I think that's a given.
Well, sure, yeah.
X-ray vision? I didn't know he had that.
No, I mean, it makes sense, but...
Yeah.
Sure.
Constructs? So basically he's Green Lantern. Constructs? Does he use constructs in your book?
Yeah, but so far relatively simple.
Okay. Energy manipulation?
Oh, wait, energy manipulation is a good one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead, Forrest.
This one just says blasts.
Oh, God. The rest are self-explanatory, like flight, enhanced strength.
Sure.
Yeah, but I didn't... Oh, and he also has omnilinguism, which I think we saw... Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't...
For sure.
It's a little, you know, relative to interacting with alien cultures, right. Like understanding Russian isn't that a big deal, but sure, yes.
Right. Given the pandemic, did the delay affect XO Manowar in any way as far as like the process or the development of the book?
It paused us for a long time. We were way ahead. We started working on this book. So like when Heather and I had our first conversation about XO, I lived in Missouri and then I moved to Texas and now I'm in Kansas. So, part of that is I moved around like an idiot for a lot, like very quickly. But yeah, we started developing before the previous series had ended. So we had a long time to figure it out and get it going and lock in. I mean, I think we plotted the first year and had the second year loosely figured out before I wrote the first issue. So by the time issue one came out originally in March, I had already written four, I think. And I did one revision of four and then got shut down. And so for the like pencils down period of the lockdown, I didn't have anything with XO to do. And so when the art team got started back up working on issues 2, 3, and 4 is when we started locking in hard plot for the second arc. So from like my work day standpoint, yes, it affected the speed of producing the book, but no, we were so far ahead that like, it's kind of just waiting.
Gotcha.
So in an ideal world, you mentioned a second arc, and I'm just curious, in an ideal world, how many issues would this run be? Do you have a specific endpoint in mind, or is it kind of set up to be continuous?
I have 2 years figured out, but
wow.
Obviously that's all like, you know, sales. That was all sales dependent from the beginning, and then, you know, there was a pandemic. So I know for sure that we have some legs, and it all just depends on sales. But sales have been, I mean, even with, because the first issue came out the last week there were comics before Diamond quit shipping.
Yeah.
And we did okay. So, yeah, like, ideally, it'll have long legs because we have big ideas. But you never know.
I have to ask, I love the banter between Eric and the suit. How do you come up with fun and natural sounding banter? Do you have to talk to yourself out loud? How do you do it?
Yeah, I read it aloud once I'm typing it on the page. A lot of times in my head, I'll kind of like hear the voices back and forth. The best way to do that, I think, is to create a voice based on someone you know or an actor or something that's easy to hear in your head for each character, so that you're not just, so the dialogue is unique for each person, and so you can hear a conversation instead of just your own voice in your head. And those two have very, very distinct and different voices and personalities. So they're really fun to write because, like, they respect each other, and they're way better together than they would be separately, because they kind of like balance each other out, but also they couldn't be any more different personality wise. So you have, you know, this supercomputer who sees all of the angles and understands like all of the potential repercussions of anything that Eric might be doing. And then you have like this badass warrior that just wants to run head first and, you know, kill everything. And so having them have a discourse in the middle of the battle is really fun, because it's kind of like a buddy cop scenario.
Right.
But yeah, one of them is the body and the other one is the mind, kind of. So yeah, we really wanted to, it's a weird way to put it because Shannara is not human, but we wanted to humanize the suit's voice, Shannara's voice, because once upon a time she was an actual living being, and we didn't want it to be just like a robotic voice in his head. We wanted a personality to come out and grow. And that allowed us to do a little more bickering, I think, than they've done in the past.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Like, imagine having Siri, like a super sentient Siri in your head, telling you that the decisions you were making in life were maybe not the best idea because of this thing that you read on the internet. It would be really irritating, but at the same time, like, that's pretty good insight that I didn't have.
Oh, totally. Like, I'll be watching TV and Siri will just come on and my partner and I will just start screaming at the HomePod to shut the fuck up.
Exactly. Right. And yeah, it's, I don't know, that's my favorite thing about the book is their relationship and how they annoy one another but couldn't do it without them with the other.
Right. Yeah, it's a really great element in the first issue and in the second issue. We had a chance to look at the second issue early, and it appears we're going to go a bit off normal path for superheroes and how they might resolve issues. I know we don't want to get into spoilers too much, but could you talk a little bit about how your approach to Exo Manowar is different than the usual solo superhero story?
Yeah, well, the challenge for Eric, like, Eric's really good in battle, right? Like, if you put him up against, you know, like an invading army, he's going to win because he has the most powerful weapon ever devised and knows how to use it. However, because of that, there are major repercussions to any fight that he has. You know, like, he crashes an airplane, or in the first issue, for instance, a alien spaceship craft is crashing down toward the city, and he catches it and stops it from destroying the city, but he drops it in the middle of rush hour traffic, which obviously pisses everyone off and makes him a bad guy in the mind of all the commuters. And we really wanted to focus on, like, how does this guy who doesn't really fit in modern society but needs to be a part of it in order to be a hero for the people, how does he learn that stuff? Because he doesn't care. Like, if Eric were left to his own devices and didn't have Shannara helping him out, he would think that was ridiculous. Like, I saved your lives. I don't care that you're going to be late to work. But that, you know, like, you don't get a lot of rope with people if you're the annoying superhero that keeps inconveniencing them, or that, like, doesn't think about the fact that an alien crashing into a Starbucks is upsetting the people in the Starbucks. So yeah, we're playing with that a lot. The damage control sort of element, where there's collateral damage to all of these things, but he has to deal with that. Like, in order to live in the here and now and, like, be a person, he has to become a part of this community that he's trying to save. So we're leaning into that. And then we also really want to build the world of Exo and the weird, crazy, I don't know how to put it, the society that he is battling against will react to him, right? Once you become a superhero on the block, you get, the Batman villain sort of idea there. So we're building on that, too. Like, every action has some sort of reaction in the book that he has to learn and grow and understand.
Nice. Yeah, so everything kind of counts and matters then.
Right.
Gotcha.
So pivoting into one that's a little more silly, assuming Bloodshot, one of the only movies eligible this year for an Academy Award, spins into a cinematic universe, who would you cast to play Manowar?
That's a great question. Oh, my God.
I mean, Liam Hemsworth is, the most logical, right?
It's the obvious answer, right? That's
a good one. Is too obvious, though. Marvel wouldn't allow it.
Yeah, I mean, you need somebody shaggy and, physically imposing. I mean, in my mind, because I don't know, a blonde bearded Thor type character, what you picture is Chris Hemsworth, right? But that's not gonna work. How about the Skarsgård that was in True Blood? Is it Eric?
Oh, yeah,
Yeah.
Oh, he'd be good, yeah. I like it.
I was thinking Daniel Craig.
Oh, Daniel Craig.
Craig is old. He's kind of got that story grizzled thing. You could kind of believe that it happened to him because he's lived through all this Bond stuff.
Sure, and he's beefy.
Yeah,
that's true. Daniel Craig would work. How old is Daniel Craig at this point?
God, he's
pushing 60, right?
I don't know. I think he's 52.
Let's find out.
Maybe we should ask Siri.
He's 52.
Okay.
Oh my God, I called it. How did I know that?
Yeah, that's funny. Works.
So, Dez, since you're appearing on the New York Comic Con Metaverse Valiant Voice panel on Sunday, even though this is being recorded on Saturday, is there anything you'd like to talk about since this show will appear or people will be able to listen to it on Sunday?
The weird thing is we already recorded that, so I know what we talk about. my main takeaway from that interview is that it's impossible to make Jeff Parker smile.
Okay.
But... no, that's a lot of fun. You get to kind of see a little tidbit of where the Valiant universe is going with all of the different launches. I think it's been interesting because everything got paused. All this stuff was supposed to have come out
a while
ago. And apart from Bloodshot, which I think it had a little hiccup, it ran for a while, we've all been waiting. So Valiant has a bunch of big bombs to drop. I think people should go watch that to see where the different books are going. I'm excited about everybody else's stories.
Nice. So are you plugged into all of that? Are you guys kind of on the same page or in a group chat? Are you having weekly calls about the entire run, the entire arc, the universe?
Well, not everybody. I've talked to Heather a little bit about the books that she's editing, and then I'm really good friends with Cullen Bunn, so I know what Shadow Man has coming up, which is super exciting. And Cullen and I have discussed what a magic versus science Shadow Man Exo crossover might look like going forward. So that is cool. A thing we have definitely put into the ether. But yeah, I think the idea is to kind of get all of the books on their feet and going and headed in cool directions and then smash them together later. So I'm excited for the prospect of that.
Nice. Do you have any other books you'd like to talk about? Are there any Gamerverse books coming?
That COVID took a real sledgehammer to our plans there because, we were developing a Gamerverse project that was supposed to line up with the Miles Morales announcement and the PS5 announcement.
Yeah.
But because COVID came in when it did and we all got work stoppage and then the release date of PlayStation 5 got pushed, there was no way to line it up. So that project... The one we were talking about went away, and going forward, I'm not sure. I would imagine if there's more Gamer stuff going forward, it will line up with the Miles stuff, so it would be down the road a little bit.
Gotcha. Oh man, now I'm all excited. I bet there's a Miles book coming or something.
Yeah, well, and they did a novelization that's supposed to be really cool.
The middle grade reader book. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. But that was a really fun project that I got to work on longer than I thought I would. And I have told them I'm interested to do more if they want to do more. But yeah, like the thing that was supposed to be like the capstone of the whole thing, COVID kind of blew up. It sucks. Right. But right. I'm excited for the game. That game looks sweet.
Yes, it does.
Graphics look insane. Well, to end our show, our last segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, we're going to ask you, what are you into right now that's not comic book related?
The Great British Baking Show?
Yeah.
I had gotten into it last year, so I had only seen the last two series of it leading up to this one. So I didn't realize that they had, like, changed cast and that, like, Mary Berry was a big part of it for 10 years. So what I've been doing whenever I found out it was coming back is I went back and watched some of the older ones, which was really fun. So watch that. What else? I feel like there's something else. I've been rewatching stuff. I rewatched all of Breaking Bad recently, which is really depressing, but a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is.
I'm a Chiefs fan, and the Chiefs won the Super Bowl last year. So football is really big in this town. And we're one of the few places where we're stupid enough to let fans come to the stadium. So. Oh. Our games look less like a scrimmage, which is kind of cool, if deadly.
Yeah.
That's basically it. I'm really boring. I've had 2 5-year-olds to contend with for most of the last 5 months.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So there's a lot of commend you.
There's a lot of Pokemon that happens in my house.
Could we see Eric doing any baking in an upcoming issue of Exo Manowar?
Absolutely. I put eating in all of... Yeah, I put eating in every single one of my books. There's a Pop-Tart scene coming up. It's really exciting. So I certainly wouldn't put it past him.
Nice. Well, Dennis, thank you so much for being on the APT Comics podcast. It's been a blast.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. It's fun to be here.